probably the thing that I failed to mention or emphasize last night that really kind of caught my attention this morning was the production that we got from a lot of different areas. People rising up and making significant plays for us. And really, I just think that that has to happen at this point in the journey that is the season.
Pittsburgh Steelers coach Mike Tomlin did what he needed to do. Maybe better said, he avoided doing what he couldn't allow himself to do. That would have been losing to the Indianapolis Colts and their human publicity stunt of an interim coach, Jeff Saturday. It was Saturday's third game coaching ever on any level. So if the Steelers lost that game on Monday Night Football, the Wolves would have been howling at Tomlin, and Tomlin specifically. No amount of Matt Canada angst or Kenny Pickett concern would have bailed him out of this one. But Tomlin and his staff at least had a better game plan than Saturday and his assistants on Monday night, and his players executed barely en route to a 24-17 victory. So Mike Tomlin, for at least 1 week, puts off being the be-all and end-all point of anger for Steeler Nation far and wide. But hey, the season's not over yet. Give it time. I'm Tim Benz. This is the Pittsburgh CityCast. Glad that you're with us here on a Tuesday after a Steelers game on Monday night. Sorry, we're a little late coming to you here for the podcast today, but that's the nature of the beast. When the Steelers play on Monday night, everything changes. Their schedule changes. My schedule changes. So you're just going to have to take my gambling advice and apply it more quickly. If you have been applying my gambling advice lately, it's been pretty good. I was on it with that pick. I took the Steelers to beat the Colts. I also had a good weekend on Thanksgiving weekend. I had a good weekend specifically for the Thanksgiving Day games, except my parlay blew up in my face because of the Patriots. Leave it to the Patriots to have a Jesse James-like play cost them a game, and I couldn't even appreciate it. I couldn't even enjoy it because it blew my parlay, where I also had the Bills winning, and they did, straight. The Cowboys winning, straight, and they did. And then I just needed the Patriots to cover against the Vikings, and they did not. So that parlay didn't hit, but I did get the Lions and Giants covering individually. So it was a pretty good Thanksgiving Day betting slate for me. And as I said last night as well, with the Steelers beating the Colts, money line with the points, however you wanted to do it, you were going to be okay on that one. I felt good about that the whole way. They are underdogs against the Atlanta Falcons by a point and a half. Actually, let me take that back. They were underdogs to open up by a point and a half. Now the Steelers are favored by a point over the Falcons, and I'm taking the Steelers, at least at the outset of this week, to beat Atlanta and get their first set of back-to-back wins on the season. I think the Steelers are victorious against the Falcons, and they continue their quest to win the NFC South. That's right. The Steelers, they are likely to finish third or fourth in the AFC North. They're already going to finish fifth in the AFC East. But look out, they could win the NFC South by way of beating the Falcons after already beating the Bucs and taking care of business against the Saints. They should beat the Panthers as well. And watch, the Steelers are going to wind up with about 7 wins, which would be the absolute nightmare scenario to finish right in the middle of the draft again and not make the playoffs and finally have Mike Tomlin's coveted, never had a losing season streak come to a close. It's all going to work out that way for the black and gold. Things did work out for the Steelers last night against the Colts en route to their victory. Kenny Pickett played his best game as a starter at his Monday night debut. 20 of 28 for 174 yards. He didn't throw a touchdown, but he did convert a clutch 2-point try to George Pickens after leading an 11-play scoring drive to retake the lead 24-17 after the team fell behind on the previous possession. Pickett ran for 32 yards as well and kept a few throws alive with his legs. While Pickett didn't throw any interceptions for a third straight game, he did take 3 sacks, but some couldn't have been avoided. Generally, the offense moved a lot better than it has previously this season. There were no pre-snap penalties. He made some throws when he needed to extend drives. The Steelers held the ball for more than 34 minutes. They converted 7 third down attempts and were 2 of 3 in the red zone. The ball was evenly distributed between Pat Freiermuth, Deontay Johnson, and Pickens. None of the numbers for Kenny Pickett were gaudy, but his increased ability to protect the ball while keeping the offense on the field and using his feet to extend plays or break the pocket, that was worthy of note. The defense was excellent in the first half. In fact, the Colts didn't get a first down until the 7:13 mark of the third quarter. ESPN Stats and Info had this unbelievable tweet. The Colts had 0 yards in the first quarter. It's the third time that a team was held to zero or fewer yards in an opening quarter of the season, and it's the second time that it's happened to the Colts. They had minus 2 yards in the first quarter when they were playing at New England. The Steelers outgained the Colts 232-71 in the first half, taking a 16-13 lead in the halftime. James Pierre had an interception. Terrell Edmonds had a sack as well. Also credit the defense for containing all-pro running back Jonathan Taylor. His 86 yards on 20 carries could have been worse if the Colts gave him the ball more often, but the Steelers defense limited the temptation to do so. When things started to unravel in the second half, a number of defenders made big plays in some weighty moments. Chris Wormley wrestled a ball loose away from quarterback Matt Ryan for a red zone turnover after Taylor fumbled a handoff. On the last drive, Minkah Fitzpatrick had a huge open field tackle that limited damage on what could have been a longer gain on a third down snap before the two-minute warning. Two plays later, Alex Highsmith came up with a sack with 1:35 left. Then Highsmith helped stuff Taylor on a third down, setting up a pass breakup by Cameron Sutton and Fitzpatrick on a fourth down to wrap up the game. Starting running back Najee Harris only got 11 touches. I missed out on an individual prop with him as a result. He left the sideline before the end of the second quarter with an ab injury. Top backup Jaylen Warren was already inactive, but the other running backs did a nice job of filling the void. Benny Snell picked up 62 yards on 12 carries. It's a 5.2-yard average. He also scored a touchdown. I did not see what the Benny Snell touchdown prop was because, honestly, I wasn't sure if it was physically possible anymore. Anthony McFarlane carried the ball 6 times for 30 yards. He also caught 2 passes for 11 yards. Pickett added 32 yards on the ground, and Derek Watt picked up a 4th down run as well. The kick coverage unit was bad. That was a problem, though. If those were the good things for the Steelers, here are some of the issues that the Steelers had throughout the course of the game of the Colts, and there were quite a few. The kick coverage unit, first and foremost, was terrible. Dallas Flowers had a return that went for 89 yards to open up the second half. It led to a touchdown, pulling the Colts within 6 points. And now they've got to worry about Cordarrelle Patterson and the Atlanta Falcons this weekend. Mike Tomlin addressed that today at his press conference.
The negative components of play, man, I just thought, like I mentioned last night, man, our kickoff coverage was not good. You know, we were missing Miles Boykin and Robert Spillane, but boy, it's unacceptable, particularly because of where we're going this week and matching up against Patterson, who is the best there is at that. And so we got some work ahead of us in preparation on a short week to shore up that component of play.
Yeah, Isaiah Rogers also took one back 45 yards. In all, the Colts returned 5 kicks and averaged 45 yards per return. That's egregious. Some apparent halftime adjustments by the Colts and Jeff Saturday made the Steelers look shaky out of the locker room, just as was the case against the Bengals a week ago. In fact, at one point, Ryan was 14 of 16 for 139 yards and a touchdown in the second half. Guarding the tight end was an issue. Jelani Woods had 8 catches for 98 yards, and Mo Alie-Cox had 2 more for 14 yards. The Steelers better improve there as the rest of the season rolls along. It hasn't been that big of an issue for them guarding the tight end, but it did manifest itself against the Colts on Monday night. And one other point to bring up regarding the Steelers and some improvement. Actually, a couple things that we can still bring up before we wrap up and get to hockey. T.J. Watt wasn't exactly at top form, hasn't found his all-pro form since returning from his pec and knee injuries. He was quiet during the game, just 3 tackles, no sacks, 1 quarterback hit. It looked as if Watt was being kept on the perimeter fairly easily by right tackle Braden Smith. Perhaps that was somewhat by design to force Ryan up in the pocket and not tempt him to try to break, contain, and roll out and get himself in trouble that way with his limited movement. But he's only sacked three times, two from defensive backs and what ended up being 40 dropbacks, although Highsmith did have a sack that we talked about before that proved vital. Watt was more or less held in check, just half a sack since his return 3 games ago. And then there's Deontay Johnson's day. He had some erratic moments. On the plus side, 49 yards, a team-high 5 catches. He dropped a potential touchdown pass prior to Snell's score. He ran backwards after a catch again, costing forward progress yardage. That's been an annoyance, a recurring annoyance with him over the last few years. Pickens wasn't exactly perfect either. He dropped a few catchable balls, but he did grab the 2-point conversion and made at least one highlight reel snag. The rookie from Georgia had 3 catches for 57 yards. There's a recap, the pros and the cons of what happened for the Steelers against the Colts. Again, give me the Steelers to beat the Falcons as a 1-point favorite. Next week on Sunday afternoon, they'll finally get back-to-back victories. The Falcons run the ball a ton. We know that. Remember that game where they ran the ball almost the entire game against the Bengals, even though they were losing by 3 or 4 touchdowns. It was like 28-7 at one point, and they still walked away throwing, I think, 13 times for the whole game. Then they had a wild shootout the next week against the Panthers that was like 37-34 in overtime. And from that point on, they have been more balanced. They've started to throw the ball a bit more often, more steadily, more regularly, at least like an NFL team. Anyway, just about every week since that game that they went to overtime against Carolina and won 37-34, they're more like in the 25 pass range at this point now for the Falcons for the most part. If they get a lead, though, they will sit on it. The Steelers have been good against the run, however, at least in recent weeks. They've faced backs like Kamara, Jonathan Taylor. Mixon didn't kill him before he got knocked out of the game. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 77, 78 yards of rushing that the Steelers have yielded in their last 8 games or 7 games. A swath of about a month and a half for the Steelers, where they've been pretty good against the run. So if that's all the Falcons are going to do, then I think the Steelers are going to see Atlanta play into their hands offensively. And with the strides that Pickett has made and the way the passing game is at least coming around to the run game, especially if Harris can come back and play, then I think the Steelers will be in good shape against Atlanta. Okay, some hockey talk. The Penguins host the Carolina Hurricanes tonight. Carolina's 3-2 win over the Flames on Saturday snapped a 5-game winless streak, 5 losses, 4 in overtime for Carolina. So they got points in a lot of those games, but still lost them. The Canes currently in third place in the Metro with 27 points, 2 in front of the Pens. The Pens entered play Monday night with 25 points, good for a tie with the Tampa Bay Lightning for the top wild card spot. After the way things shook out, they're all by themselves with the 8th place seed at 25 points. People love to use that. Where are teams at U.S. Thanksgiving? That's for you, TSN. That's for you, Sportsnet. At American Thanksgiving, are you in the playoffs or are you out? 75% of the time, that is a dictating point as to whether or not you're going to make the playoffs by the time the season ends. Over the last 14 years, Mark Recchi, of all people, outline that for NHL.com right before the Thanksgiving weekend. And right now the Penguins are in. They weren't in it as of Wednesday night. They were as of Friday night following Thanksgiving. So maybe slide the scale for them a little bit. But before face-off for the games on Monday, the Hurricanes were averaging just 2.68 goals per game. That was 28th in the NHL. However, the Canes are allowing 2.77 goals against per game. That's 8th best in the NHL. Carolina's power play is clicking at a meager 16.9%. That's 26th in the league. The Penguins are 27th at 16.2%, and their PK is really good. It's on a hot streak right now. The penalty kill hasn't allowed a goal in the past 5 games. I like the under tonight as a result at PPG Paints Arena. It's at 6. It's paying out at -107. I'm still game to take that. Pens and the under against the Hurricanes tonight. That's the way that I will lean. The Penguins pay out at -113 for the win. If you want the over, it's at -112. And the win for the Hurricanes at -103. But let's talk more hockey right now with Brian Metzer of the Pittsburgh Penguins Radio Network. based on every article that I read about American Thanksgiving, the Penguins are out of the playoffs already. There's no reason to keep the season going because as of conclusion of play on Wednesday night, even though they beat the Flames, they were in ninth place. So they weren't in a playoff slot, which means that they have to fold the tents and just forfeit the rest of the season, right?
You're right, Tim. I just got notification that I don't even have to work anymore this year. They just said, don't even bother. We're not going to broadcast the games. And we've resigned ourselves to the fact that the Pittsburgh Penguins are going to go quietly into the night. But so there it is. Thanksgiving ended up being nice, though. So there was that silver lining.
Yes, by Friday, they were back in it again. So I guess it slides depending on how you want to interpret U.S. Thanksgiving. Is it actually Thursday? Is it Wednesday at the conclusion of games? Is it Friday at the conclusion of games? Is it the weekend itself? Because technically right now, they're still in it in the eighth spot. But Mark Recchi, of all people, Mets, penned one of many columns using the American Thanksgiving barometer as the indicator as to whether or not teams are going to make the playoffs or not. This 25% quarter poll that says 75%, I think it was actually 76% of teams over the last 14 years, if you're in a playoff spot by the time Thanksgiving hits, you're going to make the playoffs. That was roughly true last year in the East. The only exception was the Bruins. That was because they had only played, I think, 16 games by Thanksgiving because of the COVID misses that they had. They were the only ones who separated from the seven that got in from being in the playoff slot at Thanksgiving. So what do you think this year? Is it going to be as true this year? Are we going to see the giant chasm develop that we saw a year ago between the eight haves and the rest who were have-nots in the East? How do you interpret the way things look right now in the Penguin state of being on the bubble at this point?
Well, there's different ways of looking at this, which is kind of interesting because I never looked at it this way. First of all, this is one of the years where Thanksgiving was later than normal. So that probably mitigates the other argument that I was just going to bring up, because on our post-game show from time to time when we talked about this same thing, because it is a hot topic in hockey circles, we brought up U.S. Thanksgiving. And Paul Steigerwald said the one night on our show, Tim, well, the season starts later now, too. It started on October 13th. So technically, it's almost a week or so later than the normal start. So maybe it's not Thanksgiving so much as the week after. But then when you push Thanksgiving back a week, how does that make it all come into view? So I do think it's still a pretty decent barometer because of the amount of games that's played. It's a quarter of the season, essentially, has been played before Thanksgiving most of the time.
Yeah, why don't they just say the 20-game mark and make it easier?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because that's if you look up and down the league, just about everybody has played 21 to 24 games, give or take. And so when you look at it that way, that seems like it's a decent barometer. Colorado is the only team I can see at a quick glance that's only played 19 so far, which you know kind of falls into that Bruins thinking a little bit where you said they had played 16 games. So for me, I think it's still important. And for the Penguins' sake, I think it was important to be in a playoff spot at this weekend that passed simply because of where they were. When you look at the seven-game losing streak and where they were in the standings at the end of it, I believe it was 14th overall in the Eastern Conference, that is very ugly and not a good spot to be in. And I think that the jump back up at least into the top 8 to 10 teams is a good spot for the Penguins because from here, we know that they are going to have their ebbs and flows. They'll reel off their 5 and 6 game winning streaks, and then they'll lose a few. But I think that once you get into that positioning, if you're collecting more points than you lose the rest of the way, you probably end up making it. So I'm happier with them being in this position than I was when they were in 14th. Because had they been in 14th at Thanksgiving, boy, we probably would have shuttered the tents, as you said, Tim, and gone home for the year.
Brian Metzer, Pittsburgh Penguins Radio Network, pregame, postgame, intermission host, Pens and Hurricanes tonight on 105.9 The X. Be listening for Brian's analysis. You can also listen to him on Pens Live weekly on Saturday mornings with Paul Steigerwald. Mets, let's get to the Hurricanes game in just a second. I kind of wanted to stick with where the Penguins are at the quarter pole, though. I saw ESPN.com give out its grades for each team so far this season. They gave the Pens a B. We talk a lot about grading on a curve with Kenny Pickett in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
I think we have to grade on a different kind of curve from the Penguins' point of view, though. I'm curving my analysis a little bit more harshly for the Pens because with their collective age, I think they have to be better early than they might be late. In other words, the points that they left on the table with that seven-game losing streak, with all those blown leads that they had, that resonates more with me than to just give them a B because, well, they're in the eighth spot. Because I think they have to be better early than late. I don't expect them to be great late because I think they're going to be banged up. I think the age factor is going to catch up with them. So I think leaving some points on the table when they did in between two hot streaks for that horrid seven-game losing streak looms large, and I kind of look at them as a C-plus or B-minus. How about you?
Yeah, I think there is something to that, Tim. I don't know that I've been blown away by their performance this season as a whole. It started pretty effectively where they won four of the first five, and then they just went into an ugly stretch that really almost made the opening look not as good. It wasn't nearly as impressive as we all thought it was. And then between the 24th of October and November 15th, they were one of the worst teams in the league. So at least in terms of the way they were losing and the way they were blowing those games, which is what you just pointed to. And I think when they do those power rankings, if you will, or grades, et cetera, because even when you look at early in the season, I think it was Dan Rosen on NHL Network, and even EJ Raddick, they were putting the Penguins in their top 7 or 10 teams in the power rankings, even in the middle of that losing streak. And then they're like, oh, wait a minute, they've now lost this many in a row. So they dropped out of the rankings. And now you start to hear whispers based on this last stretch where they had the 5-game winning streak. I know they look pretty ugly against Toronto, but it's almost a what have you done for me lately. So they see the Penguins on the winning streak. Oh, okay, they're okay. They're still the Pittsburgh Penguins. I will say this, Tim. I think a lot of the grading, though, is based on the fact that Sidney Crosby is having the kind of year that he has been having. I know that he has not been perfect defensively in some of these games. In fact, his line has looked pretty ugly in some of these games. But the fact that at his age, to be tied for the league lead in even strength scoring, to be eighth overall in the scoring race, to be nipping at the heels of the league leaders, I think that's pretty impressive stuff that has kind of put people in the mindset that, well, wait, these Penguins aren't done. But to your original point, I think they need to collect as many points as possible before the calendar flips because of what you mentioned. Age, fatigue's going to set in a little bit for some of these guys. You know as well as anybody, just having covered this team for eons like me, there are going to be guys that go on the shelf. They're going to lose a big name for a handful of games here or there. It's just the Penguin way, unfortunately. So when you have that looming, you do need to collect as many points as possible. So I think all of that kind of tells us that they could have done better than they did to this point. They shouldn't have lost seven games in a row, that they're too talented still to have had that losing streak, and things like that could end up biting them in the backside whenever it comes down to jockeying for position and maybe even making the playoffs at the end of the year. If they're in a dogfight, Tim, for a wild card position, we're going to look at the 14 points lost in those games and say, well, sorry, 13 points because they did gain one and an overtime loss, and say those are huge points that could have made it a humongous difference in the standings.
They got to get more from that third line. You know, Carter's not doing anything. Kapanen, when he plays, doesn't do anything. McGinn's been fine. Heinen is ice cold, though.
Yep.
What's going on with that third line? How do they fix that?
Well, it sounds like there was some speculation yesterday that there could be a change today. I don't know that it's going to happen or not. I don't know that I would put Kasperi Kapanen back in the lineup yet, but that's something that Mike Sullivan could contemplate doing in favor of Danton Heinen. Last year when he scratched Heinen for a few games, he actually got him going goal scoring wise again. So maybe it's, you know, a one and done. You take a night off, you go sit down and watch, and then when you come back, maybe you're Danton Heinen again, because he started the season so hot, which is what he did last year too. So for me, I think part of the problem is the center that you're using there, and that's no knock on Jeff Carter, because I still think he's done some good things. Every game, it seems like some way, somehow, he manages a breakaway or two. He just doesn't finish anymore. And I don't know what we can do to get him to start scoring goals, because that, more than anything else, has made the line look even worse, because when he's had those opportunities, he's not been able to cash them in. McGinn was on fire at the start of November, and he was kind of carrying that load a little bit, even during the last three games of the losing. And then he's been up and down a little bit at this point. So what you make want to contemplate doing is, when you shuffle things up, and they won't do this, is flip-flop Teddy Bluger and Jeff Carter, give Bluger maybe the more minutes as a third line center, and let him, because he's been great since he came back. Their power or their penalty kill has been perfect with Bluger. It's since he got back. I believe it's 17 in a row now. His offensive game looks to be in order. His speed is noticeable. He's been able to create with guys such as Ryan Poehling and Josh Archibald. If you give him a couple more talented offensive players, maybe that could get them going and get Bluger going. Carter could play a little less minutes, maybe still be an offensive catalyst with those guys on the fourth line. And then you still have two guys capable of taking faceoffs because Archibald can play center and Jeff Carter can play center. So they're not going to end up scratching a Jeff Carter. So that's why I'm suggesting maybe knock him down, put Bluger up, and see if just changing the centers around a little bit in the bottom six can get everybody going while keeping that level of productivity going on the fourth line. Because up to this point, since Bluger got back, that line's been pretty effective. And some of the nights has been a catalyst for them to either turn things around or get things going in some of these hockey games.
Brian Metzer, Pittsburgh Penguins Radio Network, with us as he always is to talk hockey once a week on Breakfast with Bens. Okay, Mets, let's get to tonight's game. You'll be doing pregame, postgame, intermissions. You're doing everything tonight for this one. So what do you know about the Canes coming in? Looks like they've been going through a rut themselves of late before beating the Flames.
Yeah, I don't know that they're the same team that has been anointed as Eastern Conference champions as they have been the last 2 years. That's all you hear in the offseason is Carolina, Carolina, Carolina. They're 3-3-4 in their last 10. They've won one there, you know, in their last game. But I don't know that anybody knew that Marty Natchez was going to be leading them in scoring at this point. He is. That's good for them because they had high hopes whenever they brought him into their organization. But I still feel like they're not getting enough from some of their other big boys. Now, that said, I'm saying that whenever Aho and Svechnikov have combined for 45 points on the season. They probably are pleased with Brent Burns to this point. He's there, right there, fourth in scoring. But Kotkaniemi, who they brought in from Montreal, has been a dud. He's just 2 goals and 5 points in 22 games. I think they envisioned him blossoming a little bit more. Seth Jarvis hasn't blossomed the way they envisioned whenever they brought him in. So beyond their top six, and it's almost the same as we talk about the Penguins here, Tim, they're not getting enough productivity, I think, up and down their lineup. Then you have their goaltenders that I think have been okay. They've almost been spread out across the three guys that have dressed for them this year in terms of their games played. They all have goals against under three. Save percentages aren't terrible, but when you're not getting the goal support that you need, I think that's been a difference maker. So I think it's probably not a bad team for the Penguins to run into right now. They are still 500, but they're not scoring the way that we know that they have in the past. And this losing stretch that they're going through, they did go to overtime.
Four
of those five games, which is something that is you kill for if you're going to have a losing streak because you still collect those quote-unquote loser points. But in those games, they scored 2, 1, 3, were shut out, and then in their last overtime loss, they only scored 2. So the goal scoring that I just mentioned has been an issue there. And even when they've won games this year, if you look up and down, they have only scored more than 4. It's 1, 2, 3 times. So it's not like they are really lighting up in terms of the offense. So I think the Penguins, if they can get their offensive boat in order, be better in their defensive zone than we saw them play against the Toronto Maple Leafs, because they regressed to the way they were in the game when Sid's line went -5 on the night, except for him, because he did score a goal. He was only -4. But if they clean that up and score some goals against Carolina, I think they'll be in pretty decent position to pick up a much needed victory to get them back on track this evening.
How'd you feel about the goaltending lately for Pittsburgh?
I think Jari has rounded a little bit back into form. I think Casey DeSmith was under siege in the last game. Looking at Twitter, there were people ready to put him on a boat out of town, which I didn't agree with because he didn't have much support. If you look at the way the game started in dubious fashion, just 40 seconds in, a terrible line change resulted in a breakaway for Mitch Marner. I called it the Medusa move because he just kind of went in and DeSmith never even moved. He turned him to stone. Beyond that, I think DeSmith was just under siege in the game. I mean, he was really under, in some duress in terms of the shots he was facing. And I think that's why he didn't look so hot. But overall, I think that as big a part of their winning as anything in the last stretch here was their goalies turning it around a little, specifically Tristan Jarry. I know it wasn't pretty against Minnesota, but beyond that, in all those other games that Jarry played, I thought he was pretty solid. The goals he allowed weren't ones that you sat there and said, boy, he should ask for that one back. I thought that Smith had dipped just a hair whenever he was given the 3 and 4 nights. He didn't look as good as he did in the first two games, and he kind of dropped off just a little bit. And I think that's why Sully went back to Tristan Jarry. But if they can get the kind of performance that they got from Jarry in this last, you know, 5-game stretch or so, I think they'll be just fine with that aspect of their game. But it's all hinges on them actually getting the defensive performance, though, because if you're going to leave guys completely unchecked in front of your goaltender, and they're not just, you know, Tim Benz or Brian Metzer in front of your goaltender, it's Mitchell Marner, it's Austin Matthews, it's the Connor McDavid type players of the NHL being left unchecked in the offensive zone, your goaltender is not going to be able to bail you out. And I think that's what we saw happening a bit during the losing as well.
All right, so my thanks to Mets. One basketball note I want to pass along to you. First of all, Pitt, wow, they blew out Northwestern. I didn't expect that. I thought they'd win, but I didn't expect them to handle the Wildcats the way that they did. That was all Pitt in that game on Monday night. Tonight, Duquesne takes on UCSB, University of California, Santa Barbara, at the UPMC Cooper Fieldhouse. Duquesne looking for its 6th win of the season as it hosts UCSB, who's at 4-1. The Dukes at 5-1. Their only loss so far against Kentucky. Keith Dambrot's team finished last year with a 6-24 record, so they can equal their win total already to start the season. Not only is this Duquesne team playing better, it's been exciting to watch. At 80.3 points per game, the Dukes are second among Atlantic 10 teams this season. Only the St. Louis Billikens are scoring at a higher clip at 80.4 points per game. Miami of Ohio transfer Dade Grant is leading the team at 19.2 points per game. Only Davidson's Foster Lawyer and George Washington's James Bishop IV at 21.3 are in front of him among A-10 players. The Gauchos, though, only yield 62.2 points per game, fourth best among teams out of the Big West. Duquesne's only loss was a 77-52 defeat at number 19, Kentucky. I kind of like the under on this one. Give me Duquesne at -2.5. The line pays out actually at -4. If you take it as it's posted at Bet Rivers at -4, it's -110. If you go my route and take it at -2.5, it's -139. If you want to slide it on the Bet Rivers app, which I often do, the over-under at 135, which actually, boy, now that I look at it, is kind of low. You know what? I'm going to read the room here and change my mind. I'll go over at 135 on the Dukes tonight against UCSB. And normally I'm on the call for that, but I won't be tonight. Josh Taylor will be. I've got Monday Night Quarterback tonight on ESPN Pittsburgh with Jerry Dulac and with Tom Bradley, so listen there. And I'll be back with you on Mark Madden's podcast on Thursday afternoon, and then the Pittsburgh CityCast back at you next Tuesday. This is the Pittsburgh CityCast, and it's brought to you by Bet Rivers. Download the app today or go to betrivers.com.
Thanks for listening to the Pittsburgh CityCast on the Bet Rivers Network.